Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is the third night, and I'm going to, there'll be four streams tonight. In 2 hours, we'll have Faust from the Netherlands, and then Snorkel Blog from Sweden, and then Radical Liberation from America. But first, I have back with me a guest who was very popular last year from Ireland, and it is the columnist John Waters. For anyone who's not, welcome back to Millennial, John.
Thank you very much.
And for anyone who's not familiar with you, could you just briefly introduce yourself?
Well, I'm not really a columnist anymore, but I used to be. I was for many years. I was with the Irish Times. I was with all kinds of Irish newspapers. I started off in music journalism, in Hot Press, an Irish music magazine, still going many years ago. And been various things mainstream until about 5-6 years ago, and then I turned my back on the mainstream. It began to go very, very seedy and nasty, and just in time. I mean, I kind of got out before things really got horrific as they have now. And so I've written 10 books, mainly about Ireland, about Irish kind of cultural and political and spiritual life, that kind of stuff. Some of it autobiographical in parts, currently you can get me on Substack. I've been on Substack for the last year and a half or so. John Waters Unchained, johnwaters.substack.com. I do stuff there, which is kind of what I do generally about all of these things: culture, spirituality, religion, music. You know, whatever, but the last 2 years has been kind of COVID all the way, so most of the stuff on there is somewhat COVID related, and probably will be for the rest of my life.
Well, we talked extensively about COVID last year. As you say, it dominates everything now. It's changed the world, it's changed life, and I think that in the year since then, that has only become more ramified, you know, the ways in which it's affecting different parts of our lives, and is now secured in doing so. It's sort of run in, it's integrated in a way. I just heard about this, I think it's in Canada, Ontario, where they're keeping the COVID pass that could have been cancelled in the middle of January, but they're going to keep it beyond that, and they're going to now make it a QR code in order to prevent fraud. So that's further integration of it into people's lives. And of course, it's preparing it for the long term. Systems are being erected all the time that they're not going to take down voluntarily.
That's right. Well, that's a strange thing about it, you know, that whereas the people who believe in the COVID thing and, you know, immerse themselves in it, initially were the ones who seemed to be obsessed with it, or, you know, now it's the people who don't, who kind of think that it's the most important thing that ever happened and is ever going to happen. Whereas
I know what you mean.
Those people are now kind of saying, well, why are you always going on about COVID? Like, I mean, they're completely immersed in it, so they don't even notice that it's there, that it's actually, they don't notice that reality's changed because that is their reality. Whereas our reality is changed, and it isn't our reality.
It's like the thing about a fish doesn't know what water is, kind of thing.
Yeah. It's that kind of vibe, you know. And this year has been very, very strange in that connection, because, you know, you can see now that, you know, this has been the year when the kind of gloves came off, when those kind of what I call the unspeakable creeps who run this locally in Ireland or in Britain or whatever, they suddenly kind of start announcing that actually it's going to last for about 5 years. You know, they just suddenly pop that out because they reckon that they've prepared their people sufficiently for it. And it turns out they have. And people don't even blink an eyelid, you know. And so we're kind of watching this and being kind of absolutely stunned by it, by the effect it's having on people. And that's the thing we've kind of come to realize as well in ourselves, that the first maybe year, we kind of just thought of it as something weird, something strange, something kind of, you know, that was, you know, unusual, was kind of problematic, that was kind of, but we kind of didn't see what was really happening. And now it's kind of got really freaky because you realize that actually they've actually changed, deeply changed the mindset of the vast majority of the people.
And yes, it's not a novelty anymore. It's become the new norm, which yes. means that they must have changed the human subject.
Oh yeah,
itself.
And at some levels it's quite scary because you see, like I think of it like that. If you think about something which we vaguely call civilizational values, whatever they would be, and I suppose we would all kind of agree, no matter what our politics, that you know a certain kind of view of freedom was essential, like fundamental, right? Liberal values, let me say, liberal democratic values. But now I have this sense that this was kind of like a very light veil that was over society and that has just been blown off in the last couple of years. And it's gone now because nobody believes in the things that they stood for 2 years ago. Like people who were liberal, people who were Democrats, clearly, that went without saying. That just didn't agree with discrimination. They were absolutely opposed to it. They never talked about anything else except how terrible discrimination was. That was the most toxic word possibly in the language there for a long time. Discrimination. I mean, whereas discrimination actually isn't such a toxic word, objectively speaking, because you know we all discriminate in all kinds of ways. We discriminate between, you know, jam and marmalade and tea and coffee and so on. But it had become a toxic word. To be accused of discrimination was almost the worst thing before like homophobia and racism really came on. But now it's like, oh yeah, discrimination is okay. What do you mean? What's wrong with discrimination? You know, like, or what's wrong with, you know, apartheid? You know, they won't say that, but that's kind of what they mean. They're saying that, really. They're saying that. So, yeah. I mean, this is like at a level, I think we've actually, I saw a guy on YouTube there, Richard Grannan, he's a psychologist. And a few months ago, he did a very interesting video where he was talking about the whole idea of a society going through the kind of the throes of what would be an individual experience of going into depression and beyond. And he was saying, well, okay, this is like maybe 3, 4, 5 months ago. Like we are, as societies, in a deep depression. And he didn't mean economically, he meant like psychically. And he said, we're about to go into like really psychic shock. And I think we've gone into that now. And we're just like dazed because it is actually, you know, I think we said last year, I keep saying the words are inadequate. We need a new dictionary. We need, you know, because like words like bizarre and surreal and deranged, they don't even touch it. So here we are like struggling for words, looking at this stuff, which is like a really, I suppose it would be a bad dream. It's the kind of a dream that would make you wake up feeling very queasy and wanting to forget it very quickly, you know.
Yeah,
that's, you know, it's
you'd
not
be relieved.
Yeah, it's a slow-burning shock. I'm astonished by that. And I mean, I've been watching this very interesting guy called Matthias Desmet. He's a Belgian psychologist. And he's been talking very, very consistently and very interestingly about mass formation, crowd formation, and the connection with hypnosis, mass hypnosis, which is more or less the same thing. And when he describes that, it's actually quite scary. If you, as a layman, I've been grappling to try and understand it. That's really, you know, the zone of attention that people have in this situation under this mass hypnosis, which is what it is as a result of propaganda and TV and all that, that they're actually not capable of taking in anything outside that focus, and that they don't care about other things. And they don't care about their lives. They don't care about what they lose. This is like what is amazing about it, that people have actually lost the capacity to talk to you in any kind of reasonable way. I find that with my family members and so on. You're having a conversation.
Yes, I think quite a lot of us, a lot of people watching will sympathize with that. I think a lot of us have had this thing where it has turned brother against brother, so to speak.
Yeah, but what I've noticed is it's like, it's really strange because what you're talking to somebody like, let's say a brother or sister or somebody like that, that you've had a reasonably good relationship with all your life. And you're just trying to have a conversation like you had a million times before. And it's actually impossible because you just meet silence. you just need complete silence.
Yeah, and it's like they're living in a different world now.
Yeah, you can actually hear the thoughts that are going on in their heads. So yeah, everybody's been saying he's gone crazy, and he has, you know.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
I get off the phone. I'll try and get off the phone now. Listen, any other news, you know? And listen, what time is it? I think I have to go out to the shops before they close. Yeah. Okay. See you there. Bye. You know, it's quite extraordinary. But I've actually noticed it in amazing situations, like people, like, because this thing affects highly intelligent people just as much, at least as much as.
Absolutely. Intelligence is not a very relevant metric here, because no. I think it affects, yeah.
It may be a disadvantage to the extent that people who are highly educated have gone through an academic process. So they're used to absorbing information. And once they've absorbed that, the science, then they're kind of converted and they're unshakable in that faith thereafter. And I think that's a big problem as well. I mean, the word is not very positive on this. That this Desmet, Professor Desmet says, or Dr. Desmet says, that it's almost impossible, I gather, to reverse, to unpick mass formation in an individual or indeed in the collective. And that there are ways of doing it, and it does wear down, and it does, you know, and it weakens the trance or whatever you would call it. But it's not a short-term thing, and it's not promising in the short term or even the medium term.
I mean, some people think that the Omicron variant and the need for the booster shot, and now the second booster shot that they're starting to talk about, and I think has actually been mandated in Israel. Yeah, so that's the fourth shot.
Yeah.
Or at least there's something, you know, I don't want to give misinformation here. Something has happened in Israel regarding the fourth shot.
Yes.
And I've heard quite a few people saying people are starting to wake up now. And I get a feeling about that as well. I've seen people normie Facebook. I've seen people saying, you know, I got the two shots. I'm fully vaccinated. That's what they were saying that I needed to do a year ago. I've done it. I wear the mask. I social distance. And now they're telling me to get a third shot. And they're telling me that we're going to have another lockdown. People are real, and it's clearly that some people, at least, definitely are realizing that the goalposts have been shifted again and again. And I think the big one was the thing about two shots, and that's it. Two shots, and we can start rebuilding something of 2019 normality. But that's been completely taken away.
I think they're middle ground people, though. I mean, I think that the real hardcore mass formation battalion, which is about, I think, 30%, are not movable. There's a 40% or so in the middle who kind of go with the winning side, as it were. And you know, so far, the winning side is the side that is doing this. And there's a certain kind of weakening among that. I picked that up for sure. And that's very, very positive. But, you know, it's incredible how long it's taken. And even now, this is the amazing thing about it. People do not seem to be able to understand that they've been conned, that, you know, this thing doesn't stop the virus being infected. It doesn't stop infection, doesn't stop you spreading the virus. They say you become less ill if you get it. But who knows? You know, where's the evidence? Like, who can possibly say, like, you know, oh, you would have died if you hadn't had it. See, you know, that's the proof, right? Well, yeah. It's crazy stuff. Like, I mean, people are actually saying really bizarre stuff, like, you know. Like,
yeah, I think there was something that came close to, okay, he's died, but if he hadn't been vaccinated, it could have been even worse.
Yeah, if he got the COVID, he'd have died of the COVID, you know, and that would have been somehow worse, you know, or, oh, he's paralyzed and he's blind, but, you know, he didn't get the COVID, you know.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It could be a lot worse.
It's very farcical.
That sounds funny, but that's actually what's happening. Like, that is actually the mindset, and that's the hypnosis. That, you know, and this is something like we have no knowledge of, we have no experience of culturally of this happening, because the only time we've seen hypnosis is in a kind of a controlled entertainment setting or on TV where it's all for fun. But but this is for real, and this is life and death. And the terrible thing is, as I understand it, is that, you know, these people can absolutely be set at other people. You know, they're like literally trained animals. They can be unleashed.
Well, this is the cliche. See, I think we might have talked about this last December. I can't remember, but definitely I've talked about this throughout this year quite a lot, that I think most of us grew up and lived our early adulthood and the last 50 years post-war. It was a liberal and rather nihilistic world where there wasn't a doctrine, there wasn't an ideology, there wasn't a prevailing Christian morality anymore. Obviously, Ireland might be different in that regard, but in Britain and America, that was the way it was. And in the 90s, you could just be everyone was encouraged to just be an individual, suit yourself, nothing really matters. You don't need to believe in anything. Just indulge yourself and find yourself. Do what you want. And that's one of the things that has. That's one of the things that I think has completely changed over the last 2 years. Because now you're not expected. You're not encouraged to pursue your own interests, your own individuality, your own future. You're encouraged to devote yourself to the well-being of the collective. And another side of this is that, you know, that absence of a prevailing morality, the absence of a prevailing culture and whatever religion, it was also the absence of conformity and what you might call hypnosis of a kind, low level. Yeah. Whereas now it's come back. And so, and we've seen, and another aspect of this, sorry to, this is the last thing I'll say. We've seen all of these cliches. In fact, I'll bring that in later. So any thoughts on what I just said?
Well, yeah, the further point that comes to me now, you know, where I am, because, you know, I grew up in, you know, slightly different kind of society, but nevertheless, that society was there, that culture was present in the mix. You know, it might've been less of a wedge than it was in the UK or in America, but it was there. And then the other wedge of the Catholic thing was getting thinner and thinner, you know, and so on. So we lived that, we jockeyed that whole thing as well. One of the things that I'm constantly struggling with now is that, you know, for all my life up to like the last 2 years, even though in the last 20 years of journalism, I was fighting things which are now very much live in cultural Marxist terms, like feminism or LGBT or whatever, all that stuff. I found myself pitted against those forces for all kinds of complicated reasons, mainly to do with the fact that I was a father of a child and had a struggle to actually have that, to protect that relationship in a culture that was very hostile, in a legal culture, etc., etc. And then I found these people were crowding in, trying to actually make things worse for me and my daughter, and try to grab all the rights that that natural families were entitled to, steal them for families that were not, as let us say, quote unquote, natural in that sense. So, but apart from that, I was kind of a very mainstream kind of person, I think, in terms of my attitude to political and social reality. I just took for granted what was there in front of me. Now, in the last couple of years, looking at this, and you know, trying to make sense of it, because it's as I say, it's very difficult to comprehend. And the way I the analogy I use and to kind of try to form a view because I about it is building a dry stone wall, right? You know, you've got a big pile of stones either side of you, and you're building this wall, and so you each time as you get higher, the stones, you have to be looking for more and more rarefied sizes of stone, and they don't fit, so you leave it back. You don't throw it away, you just leave it back. And one day, the next day, maybe you pick it up and it fits, right? And it's a bit like that, trying to put together this, so you hear what they are calling conspiracy theories, which is, of course, the wrong way around, because the conspiracy is not, the theory is not the problem. The conspiracy, whatever it is the problem, right? But people actually zone in on the conspiracy as if this was the crime, you know? It's an amazing thing. But And what I've actually started, I've been applying that that dice storm wall model to all that and say, well, does it work? And so you suddenly say you're actually in a situation where you're saying, okay, I absolutely was straight. I didn't believe in anything like weird, or I didn't believe in, you know, aliens or, you know, all that kind of stuff, whatever that might be. And I say, no, okay, well, now actually everything's now so weird that everything's on the table. I'm not throwing any stones away now. I may not ever use them, but I'm going to leave them there until I finish the wall. And what I'm actually finding is that everything I thought I knew was pretty much wrong, you know, in terms of how things were put together. And in terms of what you outlined there, Colin, I mean, like, you know, you have to kind of then say, well, like, if there are these puppet masters all the time manipulating reality, you know, whatever they're going to be called, the New World Order or the whatever, I mean, the Illuminati, whatever. I don't even know what they're called, but I have a fair idea that they're there some in some way. The Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists and all these guys, the Party of Davos and all this sort of stuff. But there's something there. And the idea that actually we've been manipulated from the beginning, so that the thing, the liberal era, which you talked about, which we always assumed it was completely spontaneous, an eruption of youthful energy. But what if it wasn't? What if it was actually creative?
These
are thoughts you have to put together now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you see how much money went into rock and roll. And, you know, I like, see, this is the annoying thing, right? Because I like a lot of the popular culture from, you know, the second half of the 20th century. And it's annoying to hear that actually there was a lot of big money that went into it, subcultures, punk even, that it probably, and the hippie and Woodstock and all this, and these things probably wouldn't have happened without that funding and without that expertise, coordination and so on. I think that the function that it would fulfill is to soften us up and to dissolve the previous strictures of society, to dissolve our connection to tradition, so that we're just loose individuals.
To addict us to our passions and our instincts.
Yes, yes.
So that we start ignoring the cognitive zone to some extent, and we're living in our baser instinct, shall we say, for want of a better term.
Yeah,
I think that's right. But you know, rock and roll, it's very interesting then, because now you see, if you flip over, and if this, let's say this, that one of the other stones is that the same people or their successors are actually now, they've now flipped the model and they're now doing the opposite to us. They're imposing all of this tyranny on us. They're taking away all the freedom and they're giving us tyranny instead, right? Now look at rock and roll in that situation. Look at rock and roll though. Look what it's doing. Watch what it's doing. In the 60s, it was all for liberalism and liberation and libertinism and all of these things, you know, permissiveness and all that, right?
And rebelling against the establishment, against the order.
Yeah, you could rely on it. Now, where is it? Apart from a tiny few, like Van Morrison and Eric Clapton and a few like that, Morrissey, you know, they're all on the other side. And this is the scary thing.
Isn't it? Isn't it so scary? Because I just want to say one thing. The Kaiser Chiefs, did you see this?
No.
Okay, you go ahead and I'll tell you that anecdote.
Well, I just wanted to say, I had a bit of a terrible fright there in the last few days, and I haven't really got over it because I'm a huge fan of Bob Dylan, right? And to me, Bob Dylan is the smoldering soul of rock and roll in the modern era. You know, he is the voice of the conscience. He's really, because he's rooted in tradition. Like he always used to say that all his songs are based on the Bible, you know, and if they aren't, they're not true, you know. That's kind of his premise that he starts with. People don't realize this about him. Like. But the other night I was going on YouTube, and I came across a series of videos that he's done, completely new stuff. Not of old songs, but like there's quite a lot of them there. They just keep cropping up, and they're all in black and white. And one of them was like Queen Jane, approximately, I think, or something, I think it's the name of the song. Very beautiful, and his voice has changed. It's very dark. The video, the voice is softer and it's more melodic, and it's kind of like he's lost that rasping kind of sound that he had for like 20, 30 years. It's very soft, very tender. And the videos are very beautiful, but they're very dark. So you can't actually see what's going on. You just see him and he's standing at a mic and there's a band in the background or a crowd around him, you know. It's all very shadowy. And I actually had watched, I think, two songs before I realized something. All the band are wearing masks. They're wearing face masks. What? You know, I'm actually totally in shock about that. Because yeah. I can't actually go and watch them now. I can't listen to the music anymore. And I'm not even sure I can ever listen to Dylan again. Because it's that important to me.
You know, I'll have to look this up because I haven't heard about this before. That is quite sinister. I can imagine feeling. I can imagine you feeling betrayed there.
Yeah,
when you totally realize,
because you know, I would have thought that you know. Now, is this more hypnosis or is it something even more sinister than hypnosis, which is saying a hell of a lot? you know, is this something that he has to do? Because there are all these rumors about him, and you know, which I don't believe. Yeah. You know, this kind of people tell me all the time that he's, you know, involved in kind of, you know, Masons and he's in, you know, Satanism and all this stuff. You know, it's, I mean, he says certain things. I mean, that's what I've always believed. He lays false trails. You know, he talks about the chief, the commander of this world. He talks in this kind of language, which could mean one thing or the other. You know. And he, well, of course, he was a born again Christian for a very strong period in the 70s and made some beautiful music out of that. Like he's an amazing artist. There's no question about it. But, you know, like you just didn't think. And then there are stories. I mean, I don't necessarily. And there are people out there who actually can, you know, talk for hours about this, that Bob Dylan was basically a creation of other forces.
Oh, yes.
You know that one, like, you know, that he went away and he couldn't play the guitar and then he went away somewhere and 6 weeks later he comes back in Greenwich Village and he was playing, like, amazingly.
Right, okay. That's another thing altogether. But I want to get back to the general...
The point is, anyway, I mean, this is, I suppose, the dry stone wall, that you start to actually now mistrust the whole world.
Yes, I understand. And I don't mean to be dismissive. I'm just, I don't know anything about this, so I can't converse about it.
No, well, I don't want to go in there. I honestly don't want to go in there.
It's scary because you think, okay, so what am I going to find myself believing or entertaining tomorrow? Yeah. How bad does it get?
I understand. What if it's true? I couldn't bear it.
Exactly.
Because we've lived, as you say, we've lived our lives absorbing this, like it meant a hell of a lot to us.
Dylan
is like really important to me. He's an important artist to people of my generation.
Absolutely. And you know, when I see the, you know, the bands that I like, I'm not going to name them, but when I see them and they're you know, they're now of a certain age, all of them, whether they were from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, they're all older than they were then, obviously. And so they're susceptible to COVID, or they definitely feel that they are. So they're very cautious. They're wearing the masks on tour, you know, that kind of stuff. So you see photos of them on their tour, their first concert in 10 years is great. They've got all the old synthesizers, and now they're wearing masks. And it's like, and I can even see it being used as a sort of fashion statement, like, hey, it's the 2020s. We might be from the 80s, but we're still up to date, you know. we're with it.
Yeah. And it has that, like, bondage thing as well, you know, to it, you know, especially the black masks and all that kind of stuff. You know, there's an element, you know, that if you like, in peacetime, they could have done this and it would have that vibe. But it doesn't now. It has an entirely different and more sinister vibe altogether, you know.
Absolutely. But the thing I wanted to tell you about the Kaiser Chiefs was that they did a concert about 2 or 3 months ago. And I think it was part of a festival. It was one of these music festivals. And they did a concert. And in the middle of it, the lead singer said to the crowd, put your hands up in the air. This is so weird. He said, put your hands up in the air. And so they all put their hands up in the air. And he said, yeah, you've got clean hands. Nice, clean hands. You've been washing them, disinfecting them. And then he said, In fact, I can just play you the audio. I'll play you the audio because this is really very strange stuff. And I might as well bring it in. This was one of the key things of this year, I think. Let me just see if I can find this. Because and the issue here is that there used to be a sense that rock and roll was rebellious. And what you find, in fact, is that they are... hold on a second. Let me just see if I can find this for you. Because there's a sense of it being cult-like.
Yes.
And I also think there's a certain that you can imagine it's come from some psychological behavioral insights team or something like that.
Well, you know, we did, I think, talk last year about this kind of strange kind of ideological kind of template that came with COVID, you know, and very early on it started to manifest itself, you know, that, you know, to be against, to be questioning of COVID or the lockdown was to be right-wing, and in fact, far right. And that created this ricochet then that allowed that anybody who wasn't against it was ipso facto left-wing. So all left-wingers converged around the COVID flag, regardless. Yeah. And that became their tribe, their club, you know?
Very much. Well, okay, that again plays into this thing. So here's this clip. This is a modern band. They're from the 2000s, so they're not that modern. But that's another thing. That's a whole other thing that culture seems to have frozen for the last 20 years.
Yes,
but anyway, we can get into that later, perhaps. So here's this audio clip.
Let's do your hands again. They're all clean hands. I'm washing them. Let me hear if you have the Pfizer vaccine. Let me hear it from Moderna. AstraZeneca. See what the anti-vaxxers.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Wow.
This breath. How's the air? Yeah, you've got clean hands. I can see. It's good. We're spraying you with gel, man.
So there you go.
That's absolutely shocking.
But
that actually reflects what I've experienced when what I picked up from, you know, my former associations in all that culture, you know, as a music journalist and in the bands. I mean, like, for example, you go down, I was down the country there a couple of months back, and there's an arts festival on, and, you know, there was gigs on, and I looked and the posters all had, you know, vaccine pass necessary to enter. And these are like kind of guys who had, you know, majored in supporting, like in Ireland, we had this thing 35 years ago, the Dunn Store strike, which was the workers of Dunn Store, the big chain here, groceries and clothes. But they had actually been fired because they refused to handle South African oranges, right? And there was a protest went on for over a year. I can't remember exactly, but it was a long time outside a picket, and all of the rockers and the folkies were on their side. You know, they were, you know, against South Africa, against like apartheid and all that. Here we now they have apartheid and they're working it.
Yes,
they're happy to work it to actually have their name on a poster that demands that an apartheid regime.
I think the distinction is, from their point of view, apartheid in South Africa was to do with an immutable characteristic. It was based on something that you couldn't change about yourself. You couldn't decide whether you're white or black, but you can decide whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated. And if you're making the wrong choice there, then you deserve to be condemned because it's a choice you're making to endanger the rest of us.
Well, yeah, but you see, they also, in another guise, the very same people talk up choice as well. You know, they say choice is one of those good words. I mean, discrimination is a bad word. Choice is actually their corresponding good word, you know, that they use all the time. But suddenly that's evaporated. Look, I don't think there's any way of justifying this. I just think that they're actually...
Oh, no, I'm not trying to justify. No, I'm just saying how they would...
My point is that I know what they say, but, like, you know, it's all for the birds because, you know, this is actually apartheid. I mean, they keep saying, oh, it's not comparable. It is comparable. This is actually discriminating against people on the basis of their choice, of their right to bodily integrity, of their fear of the consequences, of the fact that already the evidence is clear, and it is clear that the media are covering it up, that these are very dangerous substances that are being injected into people's bodies. In Ireland here, and I think this is pretty true, much true insofar as people have done research everywhere or anywhere, that the pattern of excess mortality, like, is very clear for 2021.
Now, this is remarkable. It's remarkable with the sports stars, and there was another one with airline pilots.
Yes.
Where I think it was a particular company, and all the pilots who died, it was like five in 2020, five or six in 2019, and dozens in this year. And I couldn't. I've got to check whether it's real or not because it's just incredible.
Oh, no, it is. Well, let me tell you how real it is because, you know, like, just to stay at the beginning, you know, at the very start of this, it was kind of agreed informally between everybody that the measure of all this in the end would be excess mortality. That's always all-cause mortality. That's how you decide if there was an epidemic or not, or a pandemic. And in 2020, there wasn't anywhere. There were those spikes in April 2020, but they were actually old people in nursing homes. And the people who died in April, as it were, didn't die in May, June, July, August, September, right? So there was a dip afterwards. And that was orchestrated. There's no question about it. Or it was created by stress and midazolam and all of these kind of, and maybe a certain amount of, you know, neglect as well. Now, the pattern in 2021 is really, really interesting because it's actually entirely to do with the vaccines. And you can see this correlation on the graphs that I've several sets of people have been doing studies of this. In Ireland, it's very easy because there's one website which contains death notices. And pretty much everybody who dies in Ireland is in there. Sometimes they're in twice or three times sick for different reasons, different family members. But if you weed those out, then you can get a certain sense of it. Now, there are some differences between the different sets of research I've seen and the grass, but broadly it's saying this, that in January, February, there was a massive spike. And that was when, from the 8th of January, the vaccines were rolled out in the nursing homes first. And that's where that happened, massive spike. Then there was a lull, a dip in March. And then from April, when they were there, after the vaccine started moving down the demographics, it started to climb inexorably. And has continued to climb up to the last few weeks, and I presume it's still climbing. And there's a particular feature of it, that the increase from April through to now has been predominantly not among older people, but among deaths, which are their code word, or their, you know, certain words that you find in the notices, suddenly, right, unexpectedly, after a short illness. Those three categories have actually gone up by about 20% in that period. So what you're actually looking at now, over the year, there will be something like 20% of an increase of a spike in deaths overall. That's compared to last year when there was nothing. And that will, in Ireland, I mean, Ireland obviously is a much smaller country to Britain, but it's so, we have a population of about 5 million. So we have something like 30,000 deaths a year. That would be an extra 4,000 to 5,000 deaths. Now, that's in 1 year from one thing, because there's a clear correlation. In Northern Ireland, in the 30 years between the 70s, 80s, 90s, something like 3,000 people died from the Troubles. And there was non-stop coverage of that. Rightly so, of course. There's been no coverage of this at all.
And this is one of the really staggering things about you realize how manipulated and manipulative the news is when things are just, they just decree whether something is important or not. And it's something that clearly is important. I mean, vast numbers of deaths that it's just not remarked upon. It's quite incredible to witness this.
That's a way of putting it, but I mean, it's like there is a deliberate strategy of avoidance. That's clear. It's not that they don't know. I mean, I've told them. I've published this and I've drawn people's attention to it. It's clear. It's no secret. It takes a little bit of work to do the analysis because you have to wade in and start counting and then eliminate the various duplications and whatnot. But it's an amazing story. I mean, it should be a front page news story instead of some of the
that tedious work is exactly the work that journalists should be doing.
Yeah,
that's what they used to do, or supposedly.
It's the only reason they exist. It's the only reason journalism exists. You know, I mean, unless it's just an entertainment business, which I never thought it was, and it's not particularly entertaining anymore, anyway. I mean, this is shocking to me as somebody who was a journalist in the mainstream for like 30 odd years. I cannot get my head around that actually people who sat at meetings and espoused, again, ethical values and you know, principles and codes and all this sort of stuff are now sort of saying, oh, well, you know, there's a pandemic on, so we haven't got time to do that.
I suppose that. I mean, I don't know what to say about this because it's so overwhelming when you realize. I mean, recently there was a terror attack in America, Waukesha. I can never remember how to pronounce it, and it's been completely memory hold. The media just aren't talking about it, even though it was clearly a terror attack. It was clearly a mass killing. It's the same with the grooming gangs in Britain. Largely Pakistani perpetrators, largely white victims. So I was accustomed to this stuff, but where they just choose what to report and what to bury. And then I was accustomed to them lying about things and twisting things with the Hillary Clinton, Epstein, of course, that sort of thing going on about Trump from the 4 years of his presidency. And, you know, I'm not, Trump isn't my kind of guy. I'm not going to say I thought he was a wonderful guy, but clearly they were lying about him again and again and again, the Russia narrative. So the media, I mean, I think by the end of the 2010s, I think a lot of people, certainly in the dissident right, had developed a contempt for the media and an assumption that it was rarely honest. But the COVID era has brought in, it's just a quantum leap, really.
Well, I think one of the things that all these people seem to have figured out, and I mean, I have to confess here something that I think that actually I overestimated when I was a journalist. And I mean, I overestimated the value of journalism in that sense, or at least the penetration of journalism. I misunderstood, I think, or bigged up in my own head the significance of journalism in terms of telling people what's happening. Kind of assume, you know, you write an article, you expose something, people read it and they're saying, oh, that's terrible. Why hasn't something been done about that? And that starts something. And sometimes it does. But actually, I think they've actually realized now that actually you don't have to do any of that stuff. What you just do is there's a kind of a mechanism whereby by repetition, you kind of build up an impression in the public mind that something is important. It isn't the facts of the story that suggest it's important anymore. It's the number of times it's repeated and the places it's repeated and the status it's given on the front page of the newspaper or in the headlines of the news and the radio or the TV. And so that they can actually publish something without publishing it, in a sense. They can put it in there, but people, it actually acts counter to the idea of publishing it, because people see it, they see it in an insignificant place in the newspaper, and they think it's not very important. They're just filling space with that. And you know, if people are listening, if somebody's listening to say the news at 6 o'clock, And there's a story on, maybe a fourth or fifth string story. That's, oh, that's very interesting. What's all about? Oh, that, did you hear that? You know, and then they wait for the 9 o'clock news. And they say, well, I'll find out more about it there then, you know. And it's not on the 9 o'clock news. And it all kind of just dissolves, you know, and they say, oh, that mustn't have been very, I must have imagined that. I got it wrong. Yeah, sorry. No. And you see, there's all, on the other side of this, then there's this other strange thing whereby the authorities have figured out, and journalists are doing it all the time, that, for example, this trope about the far right and COVID, I mean, that's patent nonsense. Everybody who, you know, it's just complete patent nonsense. Like, there are no neo-Nazis, you know, fighting against COVID in Britain or Ireland or any of those places. As far as I know, I haven't seen any. They don't exist. In Ireland, there are no. In fact, Politico did a survey there recently of the far right in European countries, and they're a far left publication or platform. And they found that they had various amounts in France and Germany and so on. In Ireland, they found zero far right. But that doesn't stop our police force, the Garda Síochána, from doing articles. The head of the special branch gives interviews where he talks about the Yemen, the menace of the far right, you know. And you read these articles, and there's actually nothing in them in terms of concrete evidence other than him saying this. There's nothing whatsoever.
It's a similar thing in Britain. The head of counterterrorism said, I think he said that the main threat was from far right terrorists. But you only have to look at the statistics to see that cannot be the case. I mean, it's not a ridiculous thing.
But by repetition, then you get the objective is to get the guy in the street to say it.
Yeah, it's just internalizing it through repetition. I mean, you could say it's a kind of hypnosis. The word Omicron, probably nobody knows anything about it. They might have heard contradictory things about the Omicron variant. Is it less severe? Is it more severe? Is it more contagious? Less contagious? Is it more transmissible? They might have no real idea about it, except that they've heard it, the word Omicron, again and again and again, and it's being associated with a need for another booster shot, another lockdown. So it must be serious.
Hang on. That's a really interesting thing, because that's something that's been striking me now about it, that in this year there has been this strange escalation of the kind of the slyness or the brazenness of the authorities in terms of the lies they're telling. They're not even bothering to cover up anymore. In 2020, they were trying to kind of fiddle the figures in plain sight, but they weren't really, then they would own up, say, oh, no, well, we don't really count COVID like that. You know, we count it a different way. You know, if you fall off a roof, that's a COVID, and you test for COVID, that's COVID. They would sort of say things like that, and that's terrible. But what they've actually done this year is actually much worse, because those statistics of deaths, right? You would imagine that the ones that I just outlined there a few minutes ago, you would imagine that they present a real problem for the authorities in 2021, right? So you would imagine, therefore, that they would be trying to claim them. They would be trying to do what they did in 2020, which is fiddle the figures to make it look like, well, that's COVID. They're not doing that. They haven't been doing that. So that at the end of the year, there's going to be 5,000 extra deaths or something like that, right? And you would think, well, they're going to have an explanation. But they know they're not. They know that they've created a culture that is not going to even focus on that, isn't going to think about that. And they've got a media that won't report it. So nobody will know. We will know.
Exactly.
And we'll go crazy shouting it. You'll not know that there's 5,000 people that have died of the vaccine, and everybody says, vaccine? What? No.
Yeah. And then they've got the word anti-vaxxer in their head to, discredit you. So they don't need to worry about it. They don't need to think about it. He's just an anti-vaxxer.
Would you be anti-vax?
You one of the tinfoil hat wearers?
Yeah. You laugh when you say that, by the way. That's a very funny joke, you know?
Yeah.
Like that tinfoil. If you say tinfoil hat, you have to be laughing when you say it. Come on.
Yeah.
It's a funny joke.
The other thing is that they haven't said about the excess deaths. They're obviously desperate for it not to be associated with the vaccine. So what I've seen them do is just associate it with COVID. In fact, I've even seen a COVID-related death right after this poor girl was vaccinated. she died from a COVID-related death, because it is technically COVID-related. So, you know, the words are true. It is related to COVID, since it's because of the vaccine she got for COVID.
There was a big bizarre thing that showed up in the British figures, the ONS figures there a couple of weeks ago, which is that, and this is again part of the success of the hypnosis, that, you know, it was showing like the relative numbers of deaths in the vaccinated as against the unvaccinated, right? And, you know, there is this pattern, which you can see quite clearly. The peak of vaccination rollout is followed about 2 to 3 weeks later by a peak in deaths, right? That's kind of more or less what the relationship is. But it was showing up this amazing thing whereby that the deaths in the unvaccinated were corresponding exactly to the peaks of the vaccination rollout, right? Immediately, so that immediately after the vaccination, a peak in the vaccination rollout, there would be a peak in the deaths of the unvaccinated, right?
Right.
Now, can you think what might be the solution to this conundrum? How could this happen?
I can't.
It's very simple. It's very simple. The rule is that if you die within 14 days of getting... You're unvaccinated. You're untreated as unvaccinated. So that peak is actually vaccinated people who are unvaccinated.
Right, right. And of course, that will also happen at the other end as well, because after 6 months, you're no longer considered vaccinated. So you'll become, if you then die, you'll be added to the unvaccinated.
That's right, yeah. And that's right. You see, and of course, the very fact that all vaccines have an end date, in other words, they lapse, that means that the deaths from the vaccination will lapse terminally in every situation. So as soon as they stop the vaccination rollout, if they do, then a few months later, 6 months later, you say, then all that, anybody who dies after that, they died from something else, nothing to do with the vaccination. I mean, this is a level of sleight of hand and of three card trickery that is, you know, as I say, I keep saying peacetime, in a time before this horror show hit, like it would be absolutely unthinkable that anybody could get away with it, for the simple reason that journalists would say, are you having a laugh?
It would have been seen as utterly disgraceful to be this dishonest.
And the journalists who would have been saying that are now, what are they doing? They're writing articles attacking the unvaccinated. That's what they're doing.
Yeah. I guess one of the big takeaways from all of this is just how malleable people are. And I think that has shocked everyone. I can't remember if this was said during last year's millennial, but it's something I've been talking about a lot this year, is that something we have to get used to, something we have to accept, is that we are the outsiders, and the majority of people are just not of this mentality. They just don't have the nature to question authority, because they have a need to believe in the institutions of their society. They have a need to believe that their society is good and that it has integrity, and those in authority have integrity, and that those in authority care about them, because the alternative is terrifying to them. And it's terrifying to me. And if I were to focus on it for any length of time, it would get, you know, it's a scary thought that those in power really don't care about you. You are just a bundle of molecules to them, and it doesn't matter.
And that they're actually a danger to you in certain circumstances. You know what I mean? That you know, if you went into a hospital.
Clearly they're a danger to us.
Yeah. If you went into hospital and you had some kind of asthmatic attack or something, they could put you, and they might need to boom up the figures. They wouldn't care whether you died. Let's just say it like this. They wouldn't care that much if you died. Put it like that.
Well, we know that they don't, because they're continuing with this vaccine rollout when clearly it has the effect of killing a certain percentage of people.
This is a real staggering thing. But the fact that some other people are asleep through it and won't actually, when it's over, if it ever is, will not remember it, means that in a certain sense it hasn't happened, except for us who are obviously paranoid anti-vaxxers. So that's easy to deal with, you know. But there's a bigger problem, and that sounds weird, but there's a different problem, which is in the area of personal relationships, and I don't know how to deal with this in a way, because clearly it has absolutely blighted so many relationships, possibly permanently, or potentially permanently. And I'm only beginning to struggle with this now. And what I'm trying to do is to kind of marry these kind of shock, sense, the sense of shock, with the other idea that these people are hypnotized. Therefore, they're in a certain sense as if they're kind of like inspelled or entranced. And that's kind of like almost like a kind of an illness in itself. So that they deserve to be treated, even though they're driving us crazy, and even though they might even be attacking us, that they're actually not entirely there. It's not them. And we're going to have to find some way for us, not even for their sake, but for our own sake, as time goes on, to try to come to terms with this in a different way than with anger or, you know.
Because you're arguing not only with the thing that with the possession, but you're also arguing with the aspect of human nature which enables them to be possessed.
Yes.
To get possessed. And it's always a hopeless endeavor to argue with human nature. You just have to accept it, because otherwise you're on a hiding to nothing. So I agree with you. And I think that it also absolves you of or frees you from the need to be angry with them. So yes. It's there's the old platitude, forgiveness is a gift you give yourself, which is, it's a platitude, but it's also true.
There's another great line which Elvis said in one of his movies. I can't remember which one, but it was hate bites its own tail, and that's really true, we do need, that's our next project in a sense, as this develops, is to find a way. Now that's kind of, we have to find a way to be, I hate words like being more compassionate and all that kind of stuff. It sounds very, very partisan.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to get too soft about it either. Because
it's got to be rigorous as well. It's kind of tough love in a certain sense, and I don't like that phrase either much. But it's got to be kind of like, you're not well, but no hard feelings, but, I hope you sort yourself out. That vibe. And, I'll help you. I'll help you. It's like you're dealing with an addict or an alcoholic. You've got to want to stop. And if you do, I'm your best friend. But at the moment, I'm not going to enable you in your present situation.
Okay? Exactly. It's kind of like, perhaps an analogy would be the friend who is getting over a relationship and he's obsessed with her and he won't stop talking about her. And you're thinking, right, what? This is really boring hearing him endlessly talk about this hopeless relationship that was never going to work out. But I've got to tolerate him doing this. Yes. And I've got to be there for him. And hopefully one day he won't be like this anymore. And I can try to take his mind off it in the meantime. But don't hold that against him as an intrinsic part of his character that he is like this, because it is the way he is.
Yeah, I think that's right. You've got to kind of say the things that will hopefully, maybe not immediately, he might react against you now, but when he thinks about it, like a friend once said to a friend of mine, if this is your idea of love, I wouldn't like to see your idea of hate, Like that kind of message is kind of what we need to deliver to people. And it's hard to kind of know what realm to couch it in. Like, do you say, look, it's the end of the world, by the way, and it's not the end of, it's not a health issue. You know what I mean? Like when you hear that Kaiser Chiefs thing, like you're reminded again that there's a whole section of the population, a very large section, including, hip and trendy and intelligent beings who actually think this is completely real and that there's some kind of mortal threat to the lives of young people arising from this head cold.
And a moral threat arising from the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah. It's quite a shocking thing, really. I mean, this is really... And here's the thing, we're here struggling for words. And, I presume, there are people like philosophers and poets and all those who deal with words at that level all the time. I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, but I'm not, I'm talking about a more elevated sense of the meaning of things in linguistic terms and in conceptual terms. And they're all on the wrong side.
Yes. Yes. And this is another aspect of it that we could go into, that it's depressing how the people we rely on to be objective and impartial and to be able to think out of the box, and the people we always thought could do that, have actually turned out to be very conformist and unadventurous in their thinking and doctrinaire.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, I can't, off the cuff, I can't think of any examples, but throughout the year, it's been like one public commentator after another who I thought would have been a bit more rebellious, a bit more open-minded, they're fully signed up.
I can tell you several. I mean, one interesting one is Jordan Peterson. Because, I mean, and I mean, I wrote a long essay about him in the middle of the year. Now, you know, it's complicated because he had been ill. And I'd been ill before that, around the same, maybe a few months before him, but he was very ill. And so he was kind of out of the game. And then he came back in 2020, somewhere in the middle of the year, maybe. And he just didn't seem to be aware. You know, he was kind of like, if he said anything about it, he was treating it like it was like literally as they said. And early this year, then he kind of, you know, he actually said something about the vaccines, and he more or less said, well, you know, I've taken the vaccine. And, you know, he more or less said to people who watched, yeah, well, take the damn vaccine, you know. And I wrote and then I noticed that watching his streams, that when the subject came up, when any of these kind of interviewees would bring it up, he kind of ducked, you know, and let them talk a little bit and then change the subject. And so, but now he's started to harden. He's starting now to talk. Now, the context of this is that he was like the guy who talked about, you know, the
trans,
one of his big things, yeah. You know, and yeah, the Nazi thing and the Soviet thing and so on. And he couldn't seem to put it together. Now, you know, yeah. And he is now beginning to. But there's a strange quirk actually in America, and I can't figure this out, even though I spent a lot of time over and back to America in recent years. And listening to, I mean, I'm very much influenced by a lot of American kind of voices, you know, like Victor Davis Hanson and Steve Bannon, people like that, like that I would listen to. But there's a weird kind of thread in their responses, by and large, to the whole thing. They don't see it as we see it over here. They don't see it as clearly. It's kind of like to them or something.
The American experience of COVID seems to have been very different from the European experience. And the Canadian and the Australian experience, because they're hardcore. I mean, you'll know about Australia. Canada's just a bit behind Australia. But America, they seem to, I don't know. I think the libertarian aspect of America seems to have held a bit more than it has. It seems to have protected them from the excesses of it a bit.
A little bit.
At any rate, they don't see, like the commentators on our side don't seem to be as bothered about it as we are.
No, they're not. They seem to take it more literally than we do. Now, it's very interesting because, I mean, there is one of the best kind of academics on the whole thing has been Denis Rancourt. He's a Canadian scientist, and he's done amazing analysis of the thing. And he basically says that this was an international crime. You know, it was basically murder or manslaughter on a wholesale, on a mass scale. And he can back it up. And he's done studies in America and in all over the world where he talks about this peak from April 2020. And he talks about what happened in America. And he's basically showed in region to region how you can account for the death figure without actually going anywhere near COVID or anything like that. And it's amazing stuff. Like, they're really detailed studies. But mostly they kind of skirt around it. And, you know, they kind of, it's like, oh, yeah, there's this pandemic going on. And, yeah, but, you know, Trump is going to be elected in 2024. That's kind of the vibe you get from a lot of these people, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't seem to be an existential thing for them. It's just they seem to see it as a bit of a quirky annoyance.
Yeah.
It's a bit amusing. It is annoying, but it's also kind of funny. And
Whereas
it's deadly serious.
Yeah, to us it's the end of the world, like, but not because COVID is going to kill everybody, because of everything else and the fact that the vaccine is killing everybody and whatnot. But they don't seem to be, except, I mean, there are people that isn't a general, that's a kind of a general rule, but there are exceptions, obviously. Some great doctors, amazing doctors actually coming out of America, Peter McCulloch and those guys, so really phenomenal, Zelenko and, you know, amazing guys. So it's, you know, it comes back to this thing, though, that, you know, for me, you know, the world has kind of come to an end, in effect. You know, I mean, until it starts again, it has come to an end. I mean, it's literally stopped on its axis.
Exactly. I would say it's nothing short of that. I think I agree with you. That's the seriousness of the situation. It feels like an era has ended. The era that you and I knew has ended. That we spent the rest of our lives up until this. We that was a different era.
Well, it's like as if to mix the metaphor a little bit, it's like some monster has stretched down from outer space and taken a bite out of our lives, like, and is now intent upon eating what's left of them. You know, there's that sense that they have actually, these people, without any authority whatsoever, without any democratic mandate, without anything that you could call, you know, constitutional in any context, any meaning that you might attach to it, they've just decided to do this to us, and without mercy, without compassion, without, you know, clemency, without, you know, with this intense cruelty, you know, that they allow people to die, they enforce it, they force people to die alone. Like, this can't be ever erased from history, in my opinion. Yeah. There are people, I heard Zelenko talking, and he said this is the greatest crime in history. I actually, you know, like, there's a part of me that withdraws from that idea. But then I think about it and say, well, actually, it's pretty close now. And it's only starting from what we know. They're telling us it's only starting. So, yeah, this is the biggest crime in history.
I mean, I'll not go along with that for now. I wouldn't agree with that for now, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, this time next year I'm saying the same thing. Because it does seem like the deaths can only rise. And the more shots of the vaccine are administered, the more it's going to damage people's immune systems, cause blood clots, the myocarditis, etc.
I'm actually afraid to say some of the things I know about, from what I've heard from very authoritative sources who have been right every step of the way, because what they're saying is so scary, because it encroaches on virtually every family, like virtually every family in the world maybe are affected by this, and that's waiting, it's a time bomb waiting in that family of grief, waiting for them, and it's happened already, and it can't be reversed. That's what Zelenko means, and that's what I mean.
Yeah, and of course, where your mind naturally goes to upon hearing that is, well, the institutions of society will surely punish those responsible. But what we've seen over the last 2 years is that it actually isn't very likely. There's obviously a deep corruption, and deep and wide corruption in our society, that people get away with these things if they're powerful enough.
This is the interesting thing, Colin. You know, this is something that I've thought about a lot, because, you see, we've grown up in kind of Hollywood culture. You know, we went to the cinema, and you know that no matter how horrific the movie is, the ending's going to be okay, you know? The good guys are going to win. Cavalry's going to arrive. Clint's going to clean up the town. You know, if in history as well, like, if you look at World War I, World War II, like, there were two sides. There were the cavalry was there as well. Now we could get into either one of those and start arguing and talking about the true meaning of it in the context of what we were saying earlier about everything we know being wrong. Just assuming that everything.
But from the point of view of someone in that situation,
here there is no cavalry. Everybody's on the one side. You know, it's a spaghetti western, and everybody's got those droopy mustaches and has that evil laugh. There's nobody else.
God,
there's
that's
no
grim.
There's no Clint. You know what? Where are we going to find Clint? You know, I mean, there are a few. There's a raggle taggle of anti-vaxxer, far-right conspiracy theorists. Yeah. And, you know, shake those off if you can, and still be able to stand up and fight these efforts. But really, unless some magic, some deus ex machina appears, and almost literally, it's not looking good.
Yeah. Another part of this that I wanted to, something you said a few minutes ago made me think of this, that the institutions that we thought, the what's happened is against various aspects of our culture and our legal systems, it's our moral systems. And so it's amazing that it's happened. And so what that makes you, what that inspires is, well, okay, maybe the power isn't where we thought it lay. Maybe the power lies elsewhere. And these national institutions, these democratic institutions, are actually really not where not the real seats of power in this age. And actually, it's something else.
Yeah, and there's a very malign and sinister aspect to that as well, which only occurred to me. I was talking to somebody today, and just came to my head like that, because of the kind of the pyramid structure of power and the compartmentalization of the layers and that, so that, you know, there's a need to know mechanism working its way down. That even though at the very top the intent may be pure evil, and as far as we know it is, you know, by the time it gets down about three quarters of the way to the level of, say, national governments, the compartmentalization has actually removed the knowledge of forethought aspect. And they may very well be literally implementing a rational program to stop a pandemic.
Yeah, they might well be implementing evil, but under the auspices of good. They might think that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to finish that?
That's a function of the nature of the thing you said, because that's happened in the last 50 years in power, where countries, through the globalist model, handed power upwards. And with that came that kind of double-edged thing of compartmentalization, need to know, but also plausible deniability.
Yeah, exactly. They're ceding authority, but they're also ceding sovereignty, and the need to have their own information. They're giving that responsibility away, so that they are then left in the dark, and progressively more and more in the dark.
Yeah, because myself and a colleague, Jim O'Doherty, took a legal action against this at the very start, you know, a constitutional action here in Ireland. And we were kicked back in the High Court and again in the Court of Appeal. But the Supreme Court, to which we've appealed, have now given us the right to a hearing, which will consider whether we should have been denied this leave for judicial review. But fundamental point here is that we're basically saying, there's lots of things we're saying, but fundamentally it comes down to this idea that, you know, what happened was wrong because we have rights which are given to us as of nature, as of our humanity, and they can only be overturned or suspended in the most extreme situations for the shortest possible time on a completely proportionate basis. And the logic that these people have used is the idea that they apply the precautionary principle. They were told it was a terrible pandemic. The experts said it's terrible. The model said, oh my God, everybody's going to die. You know, precautionary principle. But the precautionary principle doesn't, you know, simply go in one direction. You know, that you said basically you assume the worst, right? But then you have to say, okay, in assuming the worst and applying certain measures, what effects will they have? So we measure back from that side as well. And in the middle or whatever it will be, at the mean point, you decide, okay, that's where we're going to go now. They didn't do that. And they know they didn't do it. But they're simply saying, well, we just took the advice we got. And that's the end of it. And that basically is the end of people's constitutions and their in domestic laws and domestic protections. Because outsiders can just simply say, oh, there's a terrible tsunami coming. Therefore, you have to stay in your houses until we tell you not to leave.
Dominic Cummings, I think I can never remember what his post was in the British government. I think he was a government advisor to Boris Johnson. Yeah. And he was being interrogated earlier this year, I think around about May. sometime like that. And he said that in March last year, March 2020, February, March, the government had no idea what to do about COVID. And then the people arrived from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and had an entire program ready for, like, already cooked up and ready to just be delivered to the British government. And they were able to say to them, here, this is what you've got to do. And that it was all laid out. And so that brought clarity to the British government and, you know, the civil servants, the politicians, whatever, the advisors. And suddenly they knew what to do because yeah. it had been delivered to them. I don't know what the word would be, fait accompli or something.
Off the peg, an off the peg solution.
Yeah, off the shelf, yeah. It was just there, ready, pre-made. And suddenly they had direction. Suddenly they knew what to do. But prior to that, they didn't know what to do. And that was when Boris Johnson was saying, let's just go for herd immunity. Yeah, that was when he was saying the sensible thing. When they didn't have, and they had no idea what to do, they were going with common sense.
They had a plan already. They had a plan already, which was to allow, to protect the most vulnerable, as they say, and then let the thing work its way through the culture, and children act as a buffer to it more than adults, and it dies down, and that's what happens, and that would have happened,
yes,
everywhere. It happened in Sweden pretty much, and it's just, we've gone through all this heartache, but of course it was never about our health. I have four rules, by the way, about this, which I, you know, when I tell people, like, when you're listening to politicians, because sometimes they suck you into their logic, you know what I mean? Even if you don't believe it, you're kind of following, oh, yeah, so there might be a lockdown now because the cases are going up, oh, yeah, yeah. And they say, no. First of all, the first rule is every single word that comes out of their mouth is a lie. Second rule is they're not in charge. Third rule is it's not about your health. Fourth rule is they're trying to kill you. That kind of takes care of all the other three as well.
And a fifth one would be it's not about their wealth. It's not even about the politician's own betterment. No. It's about his superior's betterment.
That's right. Yeah, they. I mean, as far as we can tell, I mean, there have been a few instances. I mean, there was that woman in New South Wales.
Oh, undoubtedly, there are some. I mean, I know that Matt Hancock was at Davos a couple of years before all of this happened. So, God knows what secret handshake deals he's getting. I'm not implying anything. I don't want to say that. I have no evidence of that. I'm just saying it wouldn't surprise me at all. I would expect that there are, of course, there will be some politicians who are benefiting from this financially. It would be incredible if that were not the case. However, I think a mistake that people make, because everyone understands money, everyone understands profit seeking and the desire for wealth and greed. Everyone understands financial greed. And so I think a lot of people default to that as an explanation for things like, well, he did it for the money. He did it for the wealth. He's selfish. He's greedy. It's all about money. But I don't think it really is all about money. And I think that's a kind of almost a cozy platitude that people tell themselves. I mean, it's like the go woke, go broke thing is absolutely not true. It's simply not true. Partly because these companies, these corporations, are just too big to fail. It doesn't matter if they lose money. But also because the power of the media is such that they won't lose that much money. The media will shape people to receive that product.
Sometimes you look at these guys as well and you think that maybe another, I mean, because there's another trope which is about the idea of blackmail. Because that's considered to be one of the primary techniques of these elites. And that kind of fits a little bit, because if you actually look at the demeanor of some of these guys, some of the time, they look frantic. They look completely demented sometimes. And they also are exhibiting a kind of an extraordinary zeal for this that doesn't really seem to fit with what they're actually describing or anything like what happens. But even the way they're trying to exaggerate it doesn't quite seem to reach their level of intensity of their delivery, that we really have to take we have in Ireland 96% allegedly vaccination, but they're still threatening to kind of introduce measures against the unvaccinated and so on, you know, in order to get the numbers up. Why? we're way past any concept of herd immunity.
Yeah.
It doesn't work anyway. Remember the rules. It's not about your health. It's at this stage we're looking at these guys. They're completely strangers to us. Like Boris Johnson, you know, what is he going to do with the rest of his life if this just stops? I mean, where is he going to go that he's not going to be a villain, in Britain? I don't know. I mean, like, why do people do this? I mean, I know the same is true of journalists, radio disc jockeys, all these who've been pumping this stuff out. Does it ever occur to them that actually this could be the end of everything, their reputations in history, in their own time, in the rest of their lives, and after their lives? So I don't know. It's the most shocking. I mean, I don't hesitate for a moment and say this is actually, it's literally like, to me, it feels like the world has stopped on its axis. And we're waiting as though, waiting to see will it start moving again. And it may never start moving again.
Yeah. And it does feel like an absolutely pivotal moment in world history. I don't think we'll ever see anything as significant as this again. I think that 2020 was just a year that it was awful. It was the worst year that I've seen in terms of world events.
Yeah.
And now, but of course, that is just the start of this era. And I do think it's an era. I don't think it always amazes me how people seem to, like, some people seem to think that this will just blow over. No one will be talking about COVID.
I get that from some of my readers on my Substack platform. They unsubscribe, or they threaten to unsubscribe, saying, "Oh, you're always going on about, it's not all that significant about COVID. It's not a very, why don't you write about something?" And then they mention something that is genuinely insignificant.
Exactly. I'm the same. Like some people, not many, but some of my viewers have said, "Oh, you're talking about COVID again." Yeah. And I'm thinking, but there's nothing else that is worth talking about.
No.
In the face of this, there's everything else is irrelevant.
If we don't come out of this intact, it's all over. Like, unless we win this war, it is a war, and unless we win it, it's the end of everything that we have ever known and ever needed and ever desired about human existence.
Yeah.
This is the reality.
Yeah. Exactly. I think this is, I mean, I had a UK column on last night, and they said it's basically a war against evil. And it's funny because one of the aspects of 90s nihilism, and you see it now with Game of Thrones, is this idea that, you know, that there's no good and evil. But really there is. And there simply is. And I think this is why that nihilism it always offended me. I always felt, some people think it's sophisticated to not believe in good and evil. Like it's a child, these are childish concepts. I understand that, but I also just think that there's something in the fabric of reality that does require the presence, at least the concepts of good and evil.
Agree. I mean, and I would have to say that I've been struggling with that as well, because I had a deficiency, I realized, in that area. That I had a kind of an abstract understanding of evil and a capacity to accept it in an abstract way, that I was balking at, you know, the implications of it. And actually genuinely think so. I noticed that it's almost like that there's some part of me that's holding back and hoping that I'm going to be all wrong about everything here, you know, that I'm going to be wrong about everyone and everything. And that one day we wake up and then say, there'll be somebody on the TV, or I'll hear somebody was on the news at 9 o'clock last night and they explained what it was. And it's all very simple because they had to do it because A, B, C, D. I said, oh, thank God. I knew there was something. I knew there had to be, that it couldn't be this dark. It couldn't be this evil. It couldn't be this horrific. Because I can't imagine that. I'm not able to imagine it even when it's happening. I can't imagine the war. I can't imagine my life has not told me anything in my direct experience that could end, that it could end in this. And yet, objectively, I look and I hear the things, like I say, when I hear, when I know the things, when I think about the things I know about what the vaccine has already done to people. And this comes from a series of very authoritative scientists.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Oh my God, you know, there's no way out of this.
Yeah. I think that just to return to what I was saying a minute ago, I think that when you're a child, you believe in good and evil. It's easy, and it is a childlike notion, a binary. And then as a teenager, you rebel against that, and you rebel against black and white notions of things, and you tell yourself you're clever and sophisticated for understanding that everything is in shades of grey. But I think actually part of growing up beyond teenagehood and developing a genuinely mature attitude and worldview is understanding that there actually are, for all intents and purposes, that there is good and evil in the world. You really weren't that sophisticated when you were a teenager and you thought you were so clever.
And that,
it's more perceptive to acknowledge, in some sense, the presence of these things in the world.
Yeah, and that in each of us has the potential for good or for evil. And that it is, as Solzhenitsyn said, the line goes right down through the human heart. One side is good, one side is evil. And it's a question of how you manage to calibrate that in your life and in your ethical outlook and all of those things, that you have to develop that. And I mean, but that's, you know, that's what we thought civilization was. That it was making us all of one mind. And now, as I say, we find that it was a tiny, very thin ghost that was lying very lightly on the tops of our heads, barely touching, you know, not even pressing down the hair on whatever other people's heads. And now it's blown away and it's gone. And we're trying to kind of find sentences to describe what we're seeing and how it feels and what it might mean. And everybody's telling us that we're the bad guys. This is the shocking thing, that we're the guys with the droopy mustaches.
Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't believe that for a second. You know, the worst I would believe about us is that we are addicted to being rebels. Right? I think that's the worst that I can imagine us being guilty of, is that we just have to be different. We just can't. There's some silly aspect of our nature that causes us to just question any consensus. That's how they would characterize some of it.
I agree
with you. That is not the case, because frankly, I was well past that sort of rebellious phase.
It's your life. I mean, in my experience, is you are prepared to believe anything other than that the system is terrible, that it is corrupt, that it is unjust. And it's only after experience after experience after experience with me that I finally have come to this point. I mean, if you read the things I was writing 30 years ago, like, they're pretty mainstream. You know, I mean, slightly rebellious in a certain sense, culturally. But insofar as the system was, I was believing in the democratic system. I was believing in the political system. I was talking about it seriously. I wrote books which took it very seriously. You know, I believed in justice and so on. But then I had a series of experiences that said to me, I couldn't equate with it. It didn't compute. And gradually I started to kind of, you know, move to more what you might call eccentric in the literal objective sense. It's just outside the center positions. And this is where I ended up. And ultimately, like, that seems right insofar as that everything I see now in there is so rotten that I am relieved that I got out when I did. I would hate to be in there and have to kind of equivocate in any way. Or what would you do? Like, what? I don't know. I can't say for sure what I would do if I was still in there. Like, would I would hope that I would just put on my coat one day and just walk away from all this and start, you know, throwing things in back into the tent. I hope so. Well, I'm glad that I didn't have to make that choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a nice point to end on. That, yeah, the situation is very frightening. But at least we have the dignity of intellectual freedom, the intellectual liberty that enables us to judge this as human beings. And there might be some advantages to being hypnotized and part of that mass. But there are some indignities in it too, and certainly it seems to lead to very practical misfortunes as well.
It does. No, I mean, I do think that in the coming year, now that we've kind of moved to the second year, but that we have to now maybe change our approach to try and shake off the strong emotions, particularly the anger. And to start, because that's going to kill us, you know, because the injustice of this is so phenomenal that whatever that mechanism within us that calibrates justice and fairness and rightness and wrongness is kind of now, it's kind of overheating massively as a result of the outrage we feel at this. And I think we've got to try and find a way of winding that back down, that spring, to unwind it, so to loosen it up a little bit. Otherwise, it's going to crack and we're going to explode. So I think that's the next phase, because it's quite clear. They're saying it now quite openly. This is going to go on for seven more years like this, probably worse. And they could well, come the spring or the early summer, try to mandate vaccines. We don't know. They're going to do it in Austria. They're going to possibly do it in Germany. They may do it in Ireland. We don't know. And if they will do it for 4% of the population, like, allegedly, that's what's left. Like, what sense does that make? What is that about? Well, we know what it's about, because it's not about your health. It's about what we haven't got into. But, you know, it's about one of those stones which fitted perfectly, and it's over here on my wall. And we know what it is. It's surveillance, and it's ID, and it's the global grid and all that. But we have to pull back. Not in a sense of retreating, but for our own sake and for the sake of the people that we love or loved or grew up with or that we're now estranged from, to try to find some way to them, because that's to rescue them. It's like literally that they're on a ledge, and we've got to get up there without frightening them, so they jump. Like, it's a bit like that, so it's a heavy one. It's a really heavy one. Lost you there.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Yeah, I agree. It is a heavy one, and I think it would be a good idea for us to try to be calm about it, because it is very easy to feel irate and angry and scared and outraged at the injustice of it all. But that hasn't helped us to reach the public, or at least there's a limit to how much it will help us. I think ultimately we need to be as cool-headed as possible in order to seem credible to them, but also in order for us to stay sane.
To survive. I mean, no. I mean, that anger has been legitimate up to now, I think, and natural. And it would still be for a little while longer, but I think we should begin to think about finding another way that will allow us to approach people in a different way, to kind of send out a different energy. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like when I was a young guy, you know, we used to be going out and chasing women and all that, you know. If you were trying too hard, they always, you know, they could sniff desperation at 150 yards, you know. And it's a little bit like that. Like, if you're sending out that angry vibe, you're not going to be very good at talking people off that ledge.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope that next year you'll come back on and we can review what's happened. I mean, but then even as I say that, I think, well, what are you talking about? It might be a year of horrible things that we end up talking about. But,
well,
at least we can talk about them in a nice, civilized way.
We can, yeah. But also there's a possibility, you know, I mean, any time that the cavalry will come over, that there is a cavalry somewhere and they're going to come over the hill, you know, in some sense.
That is important to bear in mind, that it is very easy to think that this is just a juggernaut, a behemoth, and that there is no alternative power center to the one that's currently orchestrating things. Mm. Who knows? You know, history is replete. History is the story of one elite supplanting another elite over and over again. It does happen. And, you know, it might take... In our age, it might take something this massive, this momentous to trigger that, to start happening. I'm not sure, but that's certainly something that that could happen. But anyway, let's leave it at that, because this has been a fascinating discussion. I've really enjoyed it, and I think, actually, there are. I should check for the questions. Hold on a second. hold on. Let me just. Yeah. I should have gone through this before now. All Irish mainstream media benefit from the pandemic. They are even selling books on the pandemic for Christmas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The national broadcaster is a disgrace. You know, they're taking money from all kinds of chemical industries, advertising, all that. I mean, the chemical, Ireland is owned essentially by big pharma. I mean, we have a massive chemical pharmaceutical presence here. So that this is in a certain sense inevitable, that a medical dictatorship, if it were to start anywhere, it would start here.
Yes, yeah, and you know, there is a lot that could be said about that, about the unique condition of Ireland in all of this.
Yes. There's a lot of things. History.
Yeah.
History continues.
And someone says, "Merry Christmas! You are the best in the business." Thank you. I don't know whether he's referring to you or me, but. Either way, thank you.
That definitely sounds like you, Colin. I mean, it's I think he's probably talking about you. Yeah. You've been working hard these days, I know. Very few in the mainstream media are doing the.
Probably I'm working harder than most of them. Yeah, I would think so. So thank you very much for that super chat and that donation. Very kind. Soccer City asks, does John think that the vaccine affects fertility? And I should apologise to Soccer City, because they asked the same question of a previous guest and I didn't see it in time, so I apologise for that. Do you think that the vaccine affects fertility, and if so, by how much?
Well, I'm not a medical person, so I wouldn't know. But what I do know is people I trust say that it absolutely does. People like Dr. Peter McCullough, if you want to go into that, he's done several videos and he talks about it in detail, and he talks about its effects both on males and females, that it has elements in it that attack the fertility of both males and females very, very radically. And I mean, we've seen already that the numbers of stillbirths that have risen from the vaccine and so on. So
I've heard about that. Apparently the spike protein, if I've heard it correctly, the spike proteins are concentrated in the testes and the ovaries.
Yes, that's correct.
So, so that is rather scary. This is to do with the corruption of that we're living with. That this is the kind of thing that absolutely should be investigated, quantified, but it doesn't. No one seems to be doing it.
Nobody. It's like everybody. This is the shocking thing about it. You know, to put it at a very banal, in a very kind of basic way, you know, that there's no authority. There is no good authority. Actually, you know, Robert Bly, the American poet and writer, died there a few weeks ago, and he wrote a book back 25 years ago called The Sibling Society, in which he predicted that, you know, in the time to come, which is kind of now, that there would be a society which would have no adults, and that it would be kind of a mob of rivalrous siblings squabbling each other and pounding the chests of their fathers and calling them fascists. Well, here we are, you know, and there are no adults. There are no grey-suited men or grey-suited women to rap on the counter and say, or on the desk or on the window and say,
Indeed. There don't seem to be serious people in it. Well, if there are, they're certainly not in the mainstream media, and they're banned from YouTube.
It tells me they're not very serious, you know.
It's a ridiculous situation, and again, one that I never thought. In the 90s and the 2000s, we had this idea that freedom of speech was an essential, it was a given. So, and that was a protection against society going down a bad path. And so freedom of speech has been shut down on social media so that society can go down this bad path.
Yeah, and nobody understands anymore that concept, that that it is actually the right to dispute and to argue that actually keeps our freedoms secure. Nobody gets that anymore. And, you know, if you try to explain it to them, the concepts are alien to them.
Yeah.
So this is, again, education problem, of course. This has been in preparation, going back to the puppet masters.
Yeah.
For a long time. They've been.
Yeah, and they've created the concept of hate speech. So you don't need freedom of speech. The only people who need freedom of speech are the people who want to spew out hate speech. So... it's only bad people who would want it, so therefore we don't need it.
But curiously, the concept of hate speech doesn't cover the kind of journalist who has been spewing out hatred against people who are unvaccinated for the past few months.
Yeah, yeah. Or demonizing people like you and me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's disgusting.
No, but I mean, you see, this is part of what we need to do. We need to stop tying our brains in knots, trying to figure out how people can be so unreasonable.
We need to just get used to it and accept.
What could I possibly say to straighten out their cognitive, you know, wiring? Well, actually, nothing. Just go home to bed. don't even think about it.
All right. The final. It's not a question, it's just a comment, and this is from Garlic Farmer, and he says, important conversation with Mr. Waters. Thank you for putting this together. So, well, thank you very much, and I've enjoyed it, and I think a lot of people will have enjoyed this. So, John Waters, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much. I look forward to next year already, and, I hope we don't have to have the same conversation again. I hope that next year will be a celebratory conversation about how we won the war.
Ah, that would be wonderful. Okay, I'll be back soon with the next one. I'll need a wee bit of a rest just to get something to eat, but I'll be back soon, about 15 minutes. In the meantime, thank you, John Waters. This has been a real pleasure, and bye-bye for now.
Happy Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.